Dave, I got to tell you about this. So my wife and I took a trip last week to Cancun, Playa del Carmen. And man, it was so nice. We were celebrating my 50th birthday a few days early.
Hey, happy birthday.
Thank you very much. I'm officially an old man, 50. Yep. I got an AARP card in the mail. I don't have a lawn to tell kids to get off of, but it's not stopping me. Life is all downhill from here. Scott told me yesterday that that 40 was the old age of a young man, and now I'm in the young ages of a old man.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's an interesting way to look at that.
Yeah, it's the youth of my old age, so I'd better I'd better
enjoy it. The youth of my old age. Listen to that. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Okay, keep going. All right, so you go down to Mexico.
So go down, and it's absolutely beautiful down there. I mean, this is my first trip to Mexico. Absolutely gorgeous. And I just, you know how it is? I wanted to do stuff that I'd never done. I wanted to see stuff I'd never seen. I wanted to see a Mayan temple. So we took a bus trip to Chichen Itza to see the temple of Kukulcan, one of the seven wonders of the world. It's the one where they built it so that on the winter and the summer solstice, the shadows play their way down the side of the temple to make it look like a snake slithering down the side of the temple until it gets
what?
To this.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and I didn't know about snake, that.
There's a snake head carved at the base of the temple. So basically, it was the first light show back in like the 10th century. This snake slithers down the side of the temple, and then until it reaches the head, and that was the god Kukulcan coming down to earth, and then the winter solstice, it goes back up.
That's cool.
And of course, this is an area in Chichen Itza that has about 2,000 of these kind of structures. I mean, the Kukulcan temple is obviously the big one, but they go, if you look at this from a satellite, all of these structures line up exactly right to make different things happen or to align with certain stars or to align with certain astrological events so that at a certain time, maybe when the sun is setting, it looks like this character is balancing it on his tummy or this light shines through a special hole. And they did all of this. The amazing thing when you're standing there is that they did all of these structures, and they're huge structures made out of stone. The ones that the Spanish didn't come along later and disassemble so they could build churches out of the stones. But the ones that were left over, they didn't have so much as a slide rule. And they've got these things dead accurate so that certain things would happen in terms of lining up with stars and the sun. And we got people who want to run around the United States insisting that the Earth is flat. it kind of makes you wonder whether we're going in the right freaking direction, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know what's funny about Chichen Itza, too, is that you look at it, and symmetrically, I've always been amazed by, you know, the first stage pyramids that the Egyptians built? Have you ever seen the one, I think they even call it, like, the Crooked Pyramid or something, where it's like, yeah, we're doing our best over here. You're like, they were figuring out how to build a pyramid.
Yeah.
But Chichen Itza, the symmetry on that is gorgeous. Like, and even, frankly, it has a little capstone at the top of it. Like, aesthetically, it's very pleasing as a structure.
And there's certain echoes that, like, they have people stand at the base of the pyramid and clap their hands in unison, and it creates a very distinct, special kind of audio effect that supposedly was also planned. They've got that arena for playing that special kind of ball where they had to hit the ball through the hoop.
Oh my God, the game that literally looks impossible.
Yeah, you got to hit it with your hip or your elbows.
Yeah, it's like, good luck. It's like everything that I physically am not able to do. It's like Dave Kellett would have been dead in seconds in that game. Because, you know, the losing team sometimes was sacrificed. And it's like, nope, Dave Kellett, why don't we just immediately take you over here to the sacrificial altar? There's no way you're hip-checking a ball through this tiny little hole, sideways hole.
Well, I may have gotten it wrong, but and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure, but I thought the whole deal was the winning captain got his head taken off. Like, they only wanted to send the best to the gods.
Oh, is that what it was?
That's what I thought I heard.
Can you imagine so like, that? Like, you're at the halftime and the coach is coming around and is like, All right, boys, we're throwing this damn game. We're throwing the game.
No, I got a date.
Why are you guys playing so good? What are you, idiots?
I got a date tonight. We got to throw this game.
Listen, I got 16 more payments on my house. What are you doing? Why are we winning this game?
Yeah, and meanwhile, the other guys are like, yeah, these guys are up by 16. I think I want to just quit now.
Yeah, the other coach is like, keep doing what you're doing, boys. We're doing great.
Johnny, that whole strategy of running the other way and flapping your arms like a chicken, that's really working out for us. I want you to keep doing that. Everybody else, do what Johnny's doing. Do the chicken dance out there. I think we're going to make it through tonight. But it was really interesting. You find so much out about yourself when you're out there. So we're on, and it was a bus trip. It was 2 hours from Playa de Carmen to Chichen Itza. And they made it really clear on the bus because they're like, we are not on Latin time. We leave at certain times. And if you miss the bus, we're not waiting for you. Take a taxi to the next stop and meet us there, you know. So Carolyn and I, being from the Midwest, we are rules followers. We are absolutely, like they say, the bus is going to be leaving at 20 minutes after 2. We're there at 10 minutes after 2 because we don't want to be those people that hold everybody up, right?
Right.
And so we get there, and it's us, and we get out by the bus. Nobody's at the bus yet. The bus driver's not there. The tour guides aren't there. But we get there, a bunch of Germans and some Japanese tourists. We are all there 10 minutes early, queued up orderly in front of the bus, in an orderly line, queued right up, ready to get on the bus, right? 10 minutes early, standing out in the sun, the Midwesterners, the Germans, and the Japanese people, all the rules followers are out there just as polite, just queued right up. This guy comes around, this bus driver comes around the corner from his third Corona. You know, he's out, you know, just enjoying the hell. He comes around the corner and sees us, literally does one of those double takes like in vaudeville. His eyes bug out and he took a half step back and his hands went, wah, like in a Mel Brooks movie. And it's like, who are all these people? It's like, just the rules followers, you know, the Midwesterners and everybody else. And so we get on the bus and they had, you know, drinks on the bus and everything. So we queue up, get our orderly little pint-sized Coronas to take on the bus. And then we wait, and we wait for the couple over there from Brazil who's been taking smoochy selfies. You know that selfie you got to take with your girlfriend that when you're kissing her and you got to catch it on a selfie?
Sure.
Every freaking time this bus slowed down to less than 10 miles an hour, the phone came out and they had to take a smoochy selfie.
This is such the complaint of the nerd Midwesterner. These people who are having a lot of sex, what are they? These jerks who are happy and attractive and enjoying their life. These jerks.
This guy had to have a 48-inch chest. This guy barrel-chested and tan.
Look at these attractive people who are enjoying their vacation. Gosh darn it. Why can't they be on time?
They got to be kissing in front of the Chichen Itza temple. They got to be kissing in front of the ball field. Every time you turn around, they're freaking kissing in front of the camera. They're so busy kissing.
Meanwhile, Brad's over there standing with his black socks and his flip-flops and the zinc on his nose, and he's got his terrible Hawaiian shirt on. I just don't understand why these people have to smooch so much. Why do they have to have fun on their vacation? This is unacceptable. Look at these people having sex and drinking and enjoying themselves on their vacation. This is not the way we in the Midwest do it, but I tell you what.
They should be queued up over here out in the hot sun behind this German guy.
Yeah. Get over here and stand next to Hans. Come on, let's get out of this bus.
Unbelievable. But yeah, that was kind of the high point of my trip. Queuing up with the Germans. Also, I did something I never did before that I always wanted to do, and I'm not sure whether I'm going to do it again. I went snorkeling.
Hey!
So I was out there with the manta rays and the sea turtles. By the way, those guys on Little Nemo
I just thought of Brad's internal monologue as he's swimming. Look at all these fish enjoying themselves, having sex, relaxing. Why aren't they lining up in an orderly fashion 10 minutes early? These fish are ridiculous. We wouldn't put up with this in the Midwest.
Oh, my God. But we were out on the ocean. It was so choppy. I was starting to get pretty green around the gills by the end. I was happy to get back on the boat. Carolyn loved it. She was having a Jacques Cousteau moment. She was having a great time. But that's something I might want to try again in calmer waters. But it was all in all, it was a great trip.
I got to tell you the one time snorkeling, this is a longer story than you wanted, and I didn't anticipate launching into it, but long story short, Glo and I were in Hawaii, this is my first time ever in Hawaii, and she was watching the kids at one point, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to go snorkeling, and there's a bay called Turtle Bay, right? And
yeah.
I approached the bay from the wrong side. This will come into play later in the story. I walked in from the long side, and I go, oh, okay, here's where I go swimming. And I started swimming. I'm out there snorkeling by myself. There was like no one there.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this gigantic sea turtle comes swimming by me. And I go, wow, look at the majesty of that thing. Look at the size of that thing. And then as you do, you get a little braver and you get closer and closer to it. And then I reached out. I was like, I just want to touch its shell. And I touched the shell. And I was like, wow, feel that. That's amazing. And then I was like, you know what? I wonder if it could pull me. And so I grabbed the kind of the front of its shell by the back of its head. And it's pulling me around. I'm like, this is magical. I'm being pulled around by a sea turtle. And then like after about a half an hour of swimming, I go back in the shore. And then I come in, I exit the bay the way you should have come in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's giant signs everywhere like, don't touch the turtles, you jackasses. Listen, you tourists, you dummies. Don't touch the turtles. Like, you're introducing 1,000 diseases to them. Don't touch. And I was like, Brad, I got to tell you, like, my instant flop sweat and of, like, just the dumb shittery of having touched the turtle. And in the meanwhile, cut back to me in the bay. Whee! The turtle is pulling me around. Whee! This is magical. I'm having a magical commune with nature. 10 minutes later, listen, you dipshits, whatever you do, don't touch the turtles. Don't touch the turtles.
You can do whatever you want out there. Don't touch. And then Dave slowly looks over his shoulder to see a turtle just on his back, bobbing up and down with X's in his eyes.
Just bubbles surrounding the turtle.
It's the first turtle to ever die of Drakkar poisoning.
Drakkar Noir? That's amazing. What a great... Can I tell you, there's always so much humor in specificity, and the specificity of Drakkar Noir is what sold that. That's amazing. I thought you were going to say, I look back to the bay, and there's just one turtle, like, you just see its torso and its head out of the water, and it's just flipping me off. It's just like, you jerk! You jerk!
We got to find out how to say go home and tell your mom she raised a dummy in Spanish.
By the way, this was like a 20-foot wide sign. It was not a small sign.
It was like just underneath the sign that said welcome to the city in equally large letters and don't touch the fucking turtles.
I totally forgot a key part of the story, but this also works into it anyway, was that because I was going to go swimming down in the bay, I had left my glasses in the hotel room. So... It was funny that I literally am walking underneath this 20-foot sign, and then it's like, hey, whatever you do, dummies, don't touch the turtles. Like, oh, no. Oh, God. What did I do? Oh, God.
Did you have to do penance? Did you have to go and report yourself to somebody?
Yeah. What they made me do is I had to go stand in line with some Midwesterners, a German, and a couple Japanese people and just stand there for a while. Well, on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. My name is Brad Geiger. I'm the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and the co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclav. And Dave! Let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. I'm excited to get back to it because you and I now have both been on the road. So now it's time to get back into it, dive back into it. Now that you've been down to Chichen Itza, that was fantastic. What a trip. That's amazing.
Yeah, and great transition word, diving. We're going to, right out after the snorkeling, we're going to dive. I like the way you use language, my friend.
Thank you. We're going to dive right into it. Now that Dave Kellett has killed a 100-year-old sea turtle, we're going to dive right into it. All right, the first thing we want to talk about, because it is the first and possibly only time that we're going to get to do this for maybe a year or two, if not more.
Yeah.
And I are going to be doing a live version of Comic Lab in front of an audience, and it's going to be really fun. And it's going to be at the NCS Fest. And you can find the data for that at ncsfest.com. That's the National Cartoonist Society Fest.com. And that's going to be taking place in May. Brad is coming out here to Southern California. It's down in Huntington Beach. The whole festival is going to be amazing. There's, I think, 15 to 20 French cartoonists and Quebecois cartoonists coming to the festival. There's all over from North America, from Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, there's cartoonists coming to appear. Really great cartoonists like the Hernandez brothers, Sergio Aragonés, Daniel Close. Who else is coming, Brad? Brad and Dave are coming.
Yeah. Kathy Geiswyth is coming.
Kathy Geiswyth's going to be there. Jake Parker's going to be there. Dave Malky's going to be there.
Yeah.
There's a whole big list of about 100-plus cartoonists of really good, notable names are going to be there. So come on out, see the Comic Lab show live. It's going to be really fun. You're really not going to want to miss it if you're in Southern California. And
And that's what now, May 17th and 18th, right? Which is a Friday and a Saturday down in Huntington Beach.
Right. We are the Saturday noon show. So we're the prime, you know, the one, you know, they always give the Saturday midday shows, the big one, and they gave it to Brad and Dave.
That's right.
So you're not going to want to miss that.
Yeah. And we'll be doing a live Comic Lab, and we're going to want all of our listeners out there in the front row, because you know the show, you know what we do, and you're going to be able to play right along, and that's going to make the show even better. So,
and if you're from the Midwest and you're at the show, you're going to want to get there 10 minutes early and line up if you would.
Now, don't worry about those French and the Quebecois. They're not going to be there for another 20 minutes after, but you and the Germans get out there, queue up at 11:50 like you know you're supposed to. You got to be good, polite Midwesterners. Get out there and get in line.
I love the idea that the French are coming in 20 minutes late. Bonsoir! Hello! Oh, no. Are we late? Oh, fantastic.
Alouette, Jean de Alouette. Alouette, Jean de Alouette.
This is amazing. This is like the six words of French that Dave and Brad know. Bonsoir.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. Au revoir. Bonsoir. That's all I know. I just know how to do the casual oui. That's where you hold the cigarette, you know, backwards in your hand and you just
backwards, go,
you know, like. All right, Brad, well, let's jump right into it. I've got a question for us. If you're amenable, are you amenable, Brad Geiger?
Oh, I'm not. I haven't been feeling mean for days, but amenable, yes.
Oh, speaking of amenable, the Ringo Awards. We should mention those before we get started on the show.
Oh yeah, the Ringo. Yeah, as a matter of fact, just as we were launching the microphones, they announced the nominations for the Ringo Awards were open, and these nominations anybody can nominate, which is what I like about the Ringo Awards. That they're open for any fan to put out their nominations, and you can do that at ringoawards.com.
Right, and so specifically, if you're Brad's mom, you're going to want to remember it's evil-comic.com, and that's how you'll submit Brad for the Ringo Awards.
Yeah, and then Sheldon Comics, if you're Brad's mom,
can you imagine? Oh, Bradley, you've been a lovely son, but that David, oh, he's just delightful.
Him and that duck. I just figured out that the duck had words downloaded into its brain, and now I finally get that freaking strip. So that's SheldonComicsPlural.com. So that's what you want to know for that. And listen, you don't have to nominate Dave or Brad. You can nominate whoever you want, but they've got categories that are perfect for a guy like Dave, who's a cartoonist who does both the writing and the art. And that's unique in the comics industry to be able to pull off of both of those. And nominating something like Dave Kellett for best cartoonist really is, I think, an appropriate way for you to show your love of the Comic Lab show, right?
Well, now that's not true. I think Brad Geiger is a much better nomination. I'll tell you why Brad's a better nomination. He'll actually win it. I wouldn't come close. That reminds me, Brad, I totally forgot to tell you the story about the Hugo Award thing that happened to me this weekend.
Did you win a Hugo too?
No, hold on. You're going to love this story because it involves my humiliation. This is great. The Hugo Awards are the big sci-fi awards, right? They're tied into a convention called Worldcon, which goes around the world and is in a different city every year, right? So This year it's going to be in Dublin, Ireland. And I'm at a wedding. I'm at Beth's wedding. My assistant got married this weekend. And I'm waiting for the shuttle bus to take me to the event location. And I get this email that says, "Hey, as a Hugo nominee, here's some discounted hotel options for you in Dublin."
Oh my God!
And I go, "Wait a minute, I'm not a Hugo nominee. Why would it say that?" And so I check the website, the Hugo website, and I'm like, I'm not. I'm definitely not a Hugo nominee." And this email's like, "Oh my gosh, we're so happy to have you as a Hugo nominee. Here's your discounted hotel awards." And I was like, I emailed back in a kind way. I just said, "I'm so sorry. I think there might have been a misunderstanding. I'm not, as far as I know, I'm not a Hugo nominee, but I wish you all the best and have a delightful Worldcon." And then I get an email back the next day that, you know how you're supposed to BCC people at best, if not, email them individually? I get CC'd, not BCC'd, but CC'd to a much larger list that says, "We're so sorry. A couple of names seem to have been included that were not nominees of the Hugos. Oh, we hope, thank you for your being forgiving about it." But here's the thing.
But wait a minute. Well, you were CC'd. So please tell me you went through those and looked at some of the email addresses.
Yeah. Well, now I have George R.R. Martin's personal email, so that's fun.
Oh my God.
Anyway, there's nothing like compounding a problem with another problem, and that is giving everybody's personal emails out. So that was great.
And can we just take a second to tell our listeners, if you don't know what BCC is, put this podcast on pause, go and learn it, and learn how to do email correctly. Because there's so many times I get CC'd on these email lists, it's like, God dang it. My kids' school did it so often that I started using the same email address for them I use for, like, when I'm signing up for something that I know they're just going to spam me. I've got just an email address that I use just for that stuff. I started using that for my kids' school because they kept doing this. And then, of course, you know, they're emailing me, "Yeah, your kid is sick." And I'm like, "Oh, geez, I should have checked that a couple weeks ago."
So anyway, Brad, if you need to know the ending to Game of Thrones, you just let me know, because I'm now emailing with George. Georgie, as I call
him.
You're
now email. Do you call him Georgie? I would just call him RR.
RR? RR sounds like a dog that got its foot stuck something. RR. So I love the idea of, like, "Congratulations on your Hugo nomination." No, I didn't win this. "Oh, we're so sorry about this." CCing everyone, including, like, but luminaries of sci-fi.
Admit just for a second, your heart started beating because you thought the mistake was on the website and not on the email.
Oh, yeah. Like, listen, in a very human way, I was like, "Oh, I actually would like to win a Hugo Award." Yeah. Oh, that's a bummer. Oh, well.
That's how I would be. I'm like, "Oh, well, clearly I must be on the list. They must have just made a mistake on the website. I'm going to go announce this on Twitter right now. Hey, guess what, everybody?"
Well, you know what? Because we're headed into award season, Brad, actually, this is unplanned, but I want to talk to you about this. I want to talk to you about my philosophy of why I want to win certain awards and why it's not necessarily ego-driven. I legitimately want to win a Hugo because I eventually want to sell Drive as an episodic TV show, and it will be easier to do it if I've won a Hugo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That makes sense. That gives it a little bit of cachet.
Yeah, like, I don't want to win awards because I know that in the morning you wake up and you go, "Oh, I'm still the same person." The next day, you know, you feel great that night. Yeah. And then the next day you wake up and you go, "Oh, I'm back to the same old me," and you have all the same doubts and insecurities and stuff. So, like, I know the joy of winning an award is fleeting, but I also, for the similar reasons, I want to win an Eisner because there are certain just gains you make in a career having won an award, separate from anything ego-driven. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I totally get that. And it makes sense. I mean, approaching that as more of a business thing makes sense. If you're trying to win an award because you need the validation, then you've got, truthfully, you've got bigger problems, because that validation isn't going to come. It, the next day, everybody's going to ask yourself this: who won the Eisner Award for whatever? Who won any? Who won the Eisner Award for webcomics 2 years ago?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't. The truth is, I don't know.
Yeah, you might be able to tell me who won it last year, but the year before that, probably not. 2 years ago, forget about it. Like, I can't tell you who won it last year, and I follow this stuff,
right?
You know,
right.
Because it's pertinent to me.
I actually don't know who won last year. You're not wrong.
Exactly.
But here's the thing, though. I think the savvy artist, though, that uses it with a business angle in mind, you can use an award as leverage to level up for something else. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Listen, I was nominated in 2007. And I haven't stopped using Eisner-nominated cartoonist ever since. In every press release, every time I've got to submit a bio, I throw Eisner-nominated in there somewhere, and you can't make me stop.
Right. So,
because that might be as far as I get.
So to answer your earlier question of did my heart flutter for a moment, my immediate thought was me picturing me 2 years from now in a pitch meeting at Paramount with Drive and going, oh, well, you know, it was a Hugo nominee. And, you know, that's what my mind immediately goes to with the idea of award nominations, of like using it to get to the next thing, you know, so.
And then reality sets in, and the CEO at the end of the boardroom table says, "Who's Hugo?"
Yeah, I don't know what this Hugo thing is. What's that? Eisner's? What the hell is that? Anyway, give me the idea. What you got? What's the elevator pitch?
And then Dave slowly turns to look out the window out into the bay and sees a single sea turtle bobbing in the distance, still giving him the finger.
All I've done
serves you right, jerk off.
All I've done is kill things, Brad Geiger. It's all I've done.
If only they gave Hugo awards for murdering wildlife.
Oh God! All right. Well, now that we've moved into abusive Dave, let's transition into our first question from Scott McAvoy, and it says, "Brad and Dave, good afternoon. This is the morning, Scott. Get it together. All right. Good afternoon. I've heard both of you mention that you work with someone who does the coloring on your strips. I'm curious, how much direction do you give them when it comes to introducing something new to the strip? Do you give them very detailed instructions as to what colors the person or item is supposed to be? Brad, do you lay out the colors for any heroes, villains you introduce? Dave, did you specify what color your animals or writers were supposed to be or wearing? I know Dave has mentioned he's colorblind. Does that affect how you tell your colorist what to do? Thanks and keep up the good work, Scott." All right, Brad, you jump in on this one first. When you have a new superhero that jumps into the comic or a new setting, how much direction do you give?
Almost none. In fact, I've got a really strong philosophical feeling about this, and that is this. When I found Alex Heberling, who does the colors for Evil Inc., the reason that I brought her aboard was that her work was really, really strong. She's good at this. In fact, she's way better at it than I'm ever going to be. Like, if I stopped doing comics today and started just focusing on color, I'm never going to get as good as she is right now. That's not a overstating it. It's just the truth. It's not in my wheelhouse. And I want her to be emotionally invested in the colors of Evil Inc. So, in fact, just last night, I sent her my first note in years. Like, there was one thing I'm like, do you think maybe we can make this color a little bit lighter because I want more contrast? That was it. Other than that, I always throw in tons of new characters, generic characters, just somebody who's going to appear for the first time ever and never going to appear again. And I always want that to be 100% up to her. I want her to feel a kind of an ownership of the colors.
That's
of
the
that
exact
comic.
Word, ownership. Yep. Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. I want her to be invested, and frankly, I don't have the chops to tell somebody like her how to do her job. In fact, I don't want to be in that position. Think about it. You don't want to hire somebody or collaborate with somebody and say, okay, here's your thing. Now I'm going to tell you how to do it every step of the way. Here's a piece of gum. I'm going to show you how to chew it, you know? I don't ever want to be that way. So in fact, I think if we asked Alex, she'd probably say, I'd like a little bit more communication. But for the most part, I like letting that thing run on autopilot. I put files in the folder. She knows where to find them. She knows when something drops in there, it's time to color it. I've got dates on them, what I expect to publish them. So she kind of knows how to prioritize things. And that most of our communication is kind of unspoken. And that's because my philosophy is you're working with this person. They're there for a reason. They're there because they're good at what they do. Now get out of their way. Stop standing on their neck and let them do what they do. What do you think about that, Dave?
Yeah, so I want to pick up off the ownership word, which that Brad used, that boy, do I agree with. And part of it, I think, my philosophy, both with coloring and with the Tales of the Drive stories, which I do, which are independently produced short stories for Drive, is my theory is that the more fun some artist has on the work, the more joy that they bring to it, the better it's going to be. And so the more notes that I give them, the more direction that I give them, the less fun it becomes, the less ownership they have of it, and the less joy they feel while making it. And so it becomes more of like, you know, when you've been noted on a project for like the fourth iteration, Brad, and you're like, they want the font to be 0.6 and smaller, and they want this brown. The exact note was, can we have the brown feel more exciting? And you're like, all right, I'm going to try to implement this note.
Yeah. We've got three headshots. We want you to make them each feel important.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, well, wait a minute. If they're all important, then none of them are important. Only one of them can be important. That's what the word important means. But editors don't get that.
Yeah, we need all four of these call-outs to have an equal weight. Well, then none of them have all right, well, never mind. Anyway, so my attitude, and the thing is, I think unlike Brad, because Beth and I are in the studio, there are probably more occasional notes from me than there would be from Brad. Also because Brad's from the Midwest and they don't like to talk. So that's just a big part of, like, Brad will get to your bus 10 minutes early, but he won't talk to you while he's in line. He'll just stand there and stare at the Germans and the other tourists. But
I've got a very distinct system of nods and head tilts, and that's it.
Yeah, the Midwestern communication style. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. A couple of points and maybe a wave and forget about it after that.
Yeah, exactly. Just an acknowledgement as both of you are out mowing your lawn. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway, so. But I have to say, the few times that I make a note or a request of Beth, the requests are different because usually I'll say like, hey, like one out of 30 comics, I'll say, hey, can we make this sign yellow? And she'll be like, all right, yeah, that's fine. We can do that. And for whatever reason, it's just something I wanted yellow. But I do notice that whenever I'm sitting with her and giving notes on something, usually about a minute or two into it, I realize, oh, this is just a subjective difference. It's a parallel choice. It's not necessarily better.
Right.
And then I'll go, you know what? The way you had it is fine. I don't know why I was even making notes. I like the way you did it. It's fine. Because frankly, when you give someone enough room, and it would be great to have Beth on at some point to have her say like, no, Dave gives me a ton of notes and I hate all of them. I don't think she would. But the thing too is when you give somebody room to play, 9 times out of 10, Beth comes up with a better option than I ever would have planned. And the 10th one is just because it's like, it was a standard Sheldon, but like the other 9 times out of 10, you're like, these are amazing. I never would have thought to do this. This is so much better than I ever would have produced. Thank you for bringing your art and your talent and your skill to this. This is amazing. You know? So to Brad's point, usually when you give someone a little bit of rope, they produce excellent, beautiful things with it. Then had you said like, I want it to be brown and I want the font to be 14 points and I want it to be, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. Conversely, if you give notes, then you're taking that creativity out of the play for that person. So now they're trying to fulfill your vision as much as they can. And they don't know what that is. So it doesn't take creativity to do that. It takes guesswork and second guesswork. And you're taking creativity off the table when you're giving too many notes. Like Dave said, you can say, well, oh, by the way, this sign has to be yellow because 3 days later, I'm going to make reference to the yellow sign.
Right, exactly.
In one of the lines. So that's one thing. But when you turn that into, you know, filling out an order form for that colorist, now you're taking creativity actually off the table because they're no longer putting themselves into it. They're trying to guess what do you want,
right,
or fulfill what your order was. And I don't like that. I want my colorist to put as much of themselves into that as possible.
And just reiterating Brad's earlier point, Alex is a better colorist than Brad. Beth is a better colorist than I am. You always want to hire someone that I'm of big opinion of, hire someone who's better at you than the thing that you want done, for the thing you want done. Because if you hire as good or not as good as you are, then you're intentionally making a product that's, a final product that's going to be less inspiring, less joy-filled, less surprising, less interesting than someone who is better at it than you. And Beth coloring a Sheldon comic, honest to God, elevates it every time. And Alex coloring an Evil Inc. elevates it every time. So hire,
Without a doubt, find
people whose work that you love and whose skill that you value, and then give them the room to actually play and do and create what they were meant to do and create. So I think that puts a button on that one. Brad, what do you think?
I think so, too. I think it's time to go over to our next question asker.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics. All right, here's our question asker, Bradley J. It's Tyler Mann, and the question is, Dave and Brad, is there anything to be said for doing a Kickstarter entirely of commissions, as in those who back the Kickstarter get a digital commission? This is an interesting question. Bradley J. Geiger, what do you thought? Brad, what are your thoughts?
I'm having a hard time seeing the value in that. I don't want to say that that's a bad idea or something like that. I'm really having a hard time getting my head around that. And part of it is because I think of Kickstarter as something that you try to raise money for something that you're trying to do,
okay,
right? Like a book or a show or something like that. And I don't know that this is the best use of Kickstarters. In fact, and it might be, because I use commissions as Kickstarter rewards, right? If you back at a certain level, you get a commission. The whole thing is just commissions. It feels to me like it would be better to just open a commission list for starters and say, okay, my commissions list is open. Then you're not locked into all that Kickstarter stuff and you're not forking over, you know, the 10%. You can just have that between you and your backers. And it also is less confusion that I think is going to happen when you're just saying that I'm opening 10 commissions on Kickstarter and you can have one of them. Dave, I don't see the angle on this. Am I missing something?
Well, it's unique. I think what I'm guessing here is that they'd like to gather up some of the energy that a Kickstarter generates and direct it towards what's essentially a commission list, right?
Yeah.
And like you, my initial response is, I mean, I guess you could do it, but it doesn't feel like it's the right use of that. But then the question is, how do you generate a lot of interest in just keeping open a commission list? Because that's also a problem. You can have things that are on offer that no one notices or taking, because, you know, a Kickstarter has a certain, like, we're mentioning it a lot, we're talking about it a lot, you know. where we're generating a lot of electricity and excitement about it. But maybe what you do is you only open up your commission list 2 times a year, and it's only for 1 week, right? Like, mm-hmm. Christmas gift commissions are now open. It's we've just entered November 1st, and you guys know how it works. It's only for 10 days in November that you can order a commission from Tyler. And so here we go. And you talk about it every day in multiple formats, multiple places. And then you do the, oh boy, it's Christmas in July. It's time to do our 10 days from July to July 10th, you know. What do you think about that?
So you're talking about introducing scarcity as a way to increase information or interest. So here's where I was going, where you said, okay, running a Kickstarter has a certain kind of excitement behind it and stuff. My response to that is, well, that tells you exactly how you should be promoting your commissions, right? If you took that excitement that you generate trying to drum up interest in a Kickstarter and instead use that same approach to announcing your commission list and finding all kinds of different ways to say, here's a commission from last month. Here's an example of what you might be getting if you decide to join us.
Right.
And stuff like that. If you just took that energy and put it into your commission list instead of putting it into your Kickstarter, because the only difference between this and a Kickstarter is there isn't any difference between
the 10% that you're giving away, baby. Yeah.
Well, and of course, whatever credit card holder you're going to use is going to take a cut one way or the other. So, you know, there is that. But I don't see the advantage of doing this as a Kickstarter. If you want to generate the excitement of a Kickstarter, that's up to you to generate that excitement no matter what you're funneling it towards. Kickstarter, Patreon, Indiegogo, GoFundMe. It's up to you're going to be the one generating the interest. I don't see the benefit of the Kickstarter angle. In fact, part of me, Dave, answer me this. I have a little bit too much luck using commissions as Patreon rewards. In other words, I say at the $50 level, every other month you get a digital commission. And I've got to actually put a limit on those because it gets to be too much. I can't keep up with them. I almost wonder if commissions are working for Tyler, whether this isn't a Patreon reward instead.
Yeah.
And then it becomes ongoing.
Right, right. I mean, first of all, I can't let it go by without commenting on the fact that you said, answer me this, which just feels like I'm doing a podcast with the Riddler. That was fantastic.
Riddle me this.
Riddle me this, Dave Kellett. How does Patreon work into this? So I just like, I want you to start using that in the show all the time. Just like, well, I agree about your point about book sales, but riddle me this, Dave Kelly.
We do need to work riddle me this. I that's an underappreciated kind of entry.
As a sentence construction, it's pretty brilliant. You have to give them that. Riddle me this is really clever.
Because yeah. Riddle me this.
You know, there's only so many ways they could have written, like, answer this question, Batman, but riddle me this is amazing. So to your, now I totally lost track of the point because I had to bring up the Riddler. Oh, boy. Where were we? With Tyler was
He's doing a Kickstarter with just commissions. And I'm saying, Dave, maybe that's a better Patreon reward.
Yeah, I think to Brad's point, it is. And Brad's had tremendous success with that as a Patreon reward. I think, though, the only other reason I think that you might be wanting to do a Kickstarter is, and Brad knows about this too, is that anywhere from 1 to 8% of your backers on a Kickstarter, and 8 might be generous, come from the Kickstarter platform and not from you, right? So if I do a book, and if it gets mentioned as a Kickstarter editor choice or it gets up on the front page of Kickstarter, whatever, I will find that somewhere by the end of my campaign, 2 to 4 to 5% of my backers are from Kickstarter, not from me, right? That's all well and good. But the thing is, they're coming to a finished product that's a book that's cohesive that they can buy into easily. Whereas you're asking someone who has never seen your art before on Kickstarter to be like, whoa, look at these commissions. I'm going to get one of these.
Yeah.
And that just feels like a bigger and riskier ask that's less likely to succeed. Whereas, to Brad's point, going to your existing fan base on a Patreon or as a time-limited commission list, to my other point, I think is a better route for you.
Yeah. Yeah, because listen, Dave, what's the chances of him getting editor's choice at Kickstarter with a Kickstarter that's just commissions? What's
zero.
The chance of
zero.
Them?
Zero.
Well, I yeah. Think. They're I, not touching that.
Yeah, and nor do I think it would be mentioned anywhere. So really, to Brad's broader point there, I don't think you're going to get a lot of, I hate the phrase, but link juice off of Kickstarter. I don't think they would generate any additional excitement for you than you would be bringing yourself to Kickstarter. So I think,
and the bigger issue there is that you risk confusing things, because again, we've got this several years now of Kickstarter being used for merchandise, for books and stuff like this. And you're going to be really confusing some of your readers, because they're going to be like, wait a minute, what is this, a book of commissions? I don't understand why I'm only getting commissions.
Right.
And then the next time you do an actual Kickstarter for a book, you got to deal with that confusion that you introduced into this
thing. Right, right. Yeah, no, I think Brad's correct. And people just mentally, they don't come into Kickstarter going, oh, wait, what am I getting out of it? Like, it's already going to, you're going to have a mental leap and five extra explanations every time you mention it. Like, no, it's not a book, it's not a project, it's just commissions, you know, that kind of thing. So you'd have to be clarifying all along. So I think Brad and I are clearly not warmed to the idea. I do think introducing it, to Brad's point, as a Patreon reward, or to my point, as a time-limited commission list that you generate a lot of interest for, I think those are better ways to go for that.
I'm going to suggest, actually, before we button this thing up, not doing the time limited thing, because commissions are such a great way to make quick money when you need it as an independent artist. Like, hey, guess what? The oil pan just dropped out of my car. I'm opening up the commissions list so I can get back on the road. How often do you see that in Twitter? Which I'm not saying that's a great branding, but you see it all the time. And it's like, oh, geez, I need to make a couple hundred dollars happen this week. I'm opening commissions because it's a quick way to make money happen. I don't know that you want to close that door and say, I'm only doing commissions twice a year, because you might be kind of closing a door that you need to open next month, right?
Well, right. And as far as additional income, I will bring up unrelatedly, but somewhat relatedly, the idea that you can also draw whatever you would like as when you have free time, or at a movie, or at an event, or you're sitting at home. And just throw it up on eBay. And
you do that a lot, don't you?
I do. And the reason I do is it's very low-hanging fruit that generates like $6,000 to $8,000 a year. And why not? Because it's all drawings that I enjoy doing. They're all fun. They're all versions of either Drive or Sheldon, or just random one-offs that I had fun with. And individually, none of them are hugely impactful on my career. But taken in whole, 6 to 8 makes a couple of technology purchases possible a year, or this or that, or, you know, it's fun little extra income that doesn't necessarily make your career, but boy, sure is a nice supplemental, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what's your approach to putting original art up on eBay, as long as we're at this tangent?
My broader picture thing is always, draw, if you're going to sell artwork, always make sure you're on an acid-free paper, or a paper that is designed by nature to last a long time. There are papers that will literally eat themselves over the decades because there are acids in the paper. So you'll want to shoot for an acid-free paper, usually a paper of quality, like a vellum stock or a cardstock, something solid. Or if it's a watercolor paper, there are kinds that are better than others. And then you want to draw with archival and light-fast pens. Anytime I ever see somebody sketching for somebody at a Comic-Con with a Sharpie, I'm like, oh, stop that. Stop stop drawing with a Sharpie. They are the worst pens. The reason why is I've seen Ziggies that were drawn with Sharpie in the 80s, and now they look yellow brown. There's no black at all left on the page. It's all this light yellow brown that's super translucent, because Sharpies just disappear with light and with time. That's the background of how I do but then once I put it up on eBay, I have a pre-templated description that I modify one or two sentences. I do a couple of photos. I have one kitchen table in my house, Brad. You probably know the kitchen table that has a reclaimed farm wood look. And if you put a white piece of paper on it, it photographs excellently. So find one place in your house that you can photograph easily and quickly and produces a nice look. And then I tend to do eBays once, at least give it a week in between them or a week and a half in between them so that there's a little bit of excitement when there's a new one. And that's my general philosophy. Why? Did you have more specific questions, Brad?
What's your starting price?
I'm sorry, I didn't even think about that. I started at one penny because I always let the market decide. And frankly, the goal is to get eyeballs on it. And so if you say starting price $200, you immediately have half the world going, "Well, I'm not paying that. Why would I pay that?
I'm out.
I'm immediately out." But if you say, "Hey, one penny," and it's not wrong, you are starting it at one penny. They go, "You know what? Mm-hmm. I have a chance. Why not? I'll jump over there and throw in on a $5." And then what tends to happen, Brad, is if they're a little bit interested at $5, maybe they're still interested at $100. Maybe they're still interested at $200. Maybe they're still interested at $300. Once they've a little bit become emotionally involved in it, you'd be surprised. Yes. Some people will stick around, you know?
That's the part I wanted to get to. In other words, once you've made...
What a long walk for that. You're like, finally, the dummy finally got there. I was feeding him and feeding him.
No, because it's when you started doing that, I'm like, penny? This guy's a dummy. And then I started thinking about it and I'm like, okay, I see what he's doing here because again, you're creating that mental investment where the person, when they put their bid down, they've signed in, they put a bid down, they've done everything they need to do to get locked into this thing for eBay. Now they're emotionally invested. They've pictured themselves owning this original art.
Right.
They've got it right in their brain.
They already started thinking about where they're going to put it in the house, you know, Brad?
Yes. And now you've got them. And it's just a question of how much. Now, because you've done that with 3 or 4 or 20 or 30 brains out there that are all picturing we're going to put this little Flacco out there in a frame. And once that happens, it's just a question of who's going to walk the highest up the ladder. And they're going to each be nudging each other because they've each decided they're going to put it in their kitchen. And that's going to work out beautifully for you. So that was something I really, when you first started doing it, I did not see the intelligence behind it. But now that I see the strategy, it's such a smart idea.
Oh, thanks. Well, I'm glad you enjoy that. And there are also, if you want to look online, there are times and dates that are particularly good to have an eBay end on. Mm-hmm. So you, in general, you never want to have them end on the weekend for all the reasons that we know about is that people live their life on the weekend. They're not paying attention to anything. So tend to do it on a time where people are at their desk on the West Coast, at their desk on the East Coast, or maybe done with dinner on Europe, in Western Europe. And so if you try to time it for then, you'll get the bulk of the people that potentially could be your audience. And so I think I have to look at my scheduling, but I usually end it, I think, at 11 a.m. Pacific, which is 3 p.m. Eastern. Yep. Which I think is like 7 p.m. Western Europe. I'd have to double check. But anyway, it tends to work out as a pretty good time if you do it about then, because everybody's at their desk. And if they're on the Pacific Coast, they're like excited to go to lunch, but they're still stuck. If they're on the East Coast, they've got the mid-afternoon doldrums. And if they're in Europe, they've finished dinner, they're done doing the dishes, and now they got their laptop on their lap. And they're like, oh, maybe I'll check in on that eBay kind of thing. So that's what I do with that. Boy, here's a topic we totally didn't anticipate talking about today, but it's worth mentioning. So this is good.
And it's a good one.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you what, let's see if we can tackle one more $5 question asker. What do you think?
Question asker. It's going to be it's going to be on my gravestone. Here lies Dave Kellett. He had to hear the phrase question asker 1,000 times. Go ahead. Read me the question from the question asker.
He's going to meet that big question asker in the sky.
Riddle me this, God.
All right, Bill Kirschbaum writes, I'm looking for tips to get the most out of comic cons in my area this year. I write a webcomic, and my illustrator lives across the country. It doesn't make sense to have a booth because we don't have anything to sell at this point, and there's no one on my end to do commissions. Can someone in my situation get anything of value from attending a Comic-Con?
Wow, this is a great question. So I'm going to jump in on this one, Brad, because I'm a tiny bit more amenable about Comic-Cons than Brad is. And so I think this makes it all the more impactful when I say, I don't see a tremendous amount of value of you going to a Comic-Con. Why are you laughing?
But I thought you were going to find some like middle ground, but hearing you go all the way to no is delightful because the answer is no. The answer is a hard no. But I thought you were going to find like a little something to kind of equivocate. But I'm very happy to hear your answer. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, okay, now I'm going to walk it back a little bit and say, if you wanted to go to a local show where there's no real travel, no real hotel expenses, and it's just you buying an attendee badge just to see what's up. If you've never been to a Comic-Con,
you just
want to see what's up at a Comic-Con, maybe make a few introductions, see how people are creating their books, see how people are displaying their books on a table. I wouldn't particularly judge you for that. I think that's actually savvy. I definitely don't see any reason why you would ever plunk down exhibitor fees for a table. I think that's straight out, especially until you have merch or a book ready to go. And until you figured out a geographical location that both of you could get to easily and affordably. Because as is always, you don't want to do a show just to do a show. It's got to be profitable for you. So I think in this description of your life and this point of your career, I can't see a way that you could ever exhibit. But maybe if it's a local show and you're not traveling and you're not spending for a hotel, by all means, go attend and have fun, make a few contacts and learn a few things as you do a walkabout. Brad, what are your thoughts on that?
Agree 100%. Yeah, don't become one of these people that say, I'm going to go because I'm going to get a table because it's good promotion. I don't really buy that. Nobody's paying attention. You can hand them a flyer. 90% of the flyers you hand out wind up in the trash or at the bottom of a bag that never gets opened again. And I'm not a big fan of promotion that's not clickable, right? Unless you can click and go to my website or one of my social media feeds, I'm not very torn up about the importance of promotion unless you can click it. And networking, realistically, how much networking are you going to do?
I don't love the idea unless it's clickable. Brad, like Brad's kids come home with some artwork. Daddy, look at this beautiful artwork. Is it clickable? I don't want to look at it. All right, Brad Geiger. I don't like it unless it's clickable.
Get out of here. Until it's got pixels on there, I'm not even going to look at it. Just take it right to the recycling. Take it where I'm going to take it as soon as your back is turned. Right to the recycling.
Riddle me this. No, what trash can is this going into? The one right next to me.
The closest one I can get it in. Get this shit out of here. No, I don't buy the promotion thing, and I don't buy the networking thing unless you're one heck of a talker and you're, you know, real smooth and you make friends easily. And let's face it, that's very few of us. And what kind of networking are you going to do? With whom are you going to network? All of that stuff. I think we build it up to be more than what it is. And please don't be one of these people that go out on social media. I see this all the time. It grinds my teeth. They go, I just got accepted to the Hoop-De-Doo Comic-Con. This is so great. Now I've got to run out and try to make a bunch of books to sell at the table. You know, they're running out to Kinko's so they can make a bunch of books, or they can make some things, or they're printing things out on their home printer. Now I get to make it. The problem with that is I'm gonna tell you two truths about that whole. Now I got to make some stuff for my table. Number one, the stuff isn't going to be really high quality. You're not going to do great. It's when people are out there looking at that and then take a look at an actual offset printed book, your stuff is going to pale in comparison. And that's not a good place to be, number one. And number two, when there's too much of that, especially in Artist Alley, you participate in turning Artist Alley into a flea market. And that's bringing the quality down for everybody. I've been in a lot of artist alleys where there's like way too much of that. And it's like, you know what? The quality of my stuff is being perceived lower just by being in this aisle, you know?
Yeah.
You're making it into a freaking flea market. You're selling a bunch of stuff out of your garage. It's become a garage sale, you know? Come on. it's okay to set this one out until you've got books that you've done a Kickstarter for, and you've got some stock that's sitting in your closet or in your garage that's waiting to sell. It's okay to set it out. Don't turn Artist Alley into a flea market. I really dislike that. Am I a curmudgeon for saying that?
No, not at all. In fact, the last two shows that I've gone to have had really good artist alleys.
Yeah.
Both Emerald City Comic Con and WonderCon in Anaheim here. It was a couple weekends ago. And I got to tell you, by not having it be a flea market, you're encouraging the next person to turn down that aisle and keep walking down that whole row. You know what I mean? But
you can
contribute to a mood that keeps people. So what happens is you end up turning it into a ghost town, you know, because people can sense like, nope, nothing down this road that I want to see. Boop, bye, here we go. But if all you need is a majority, if the majority of the people on that artist alley are producing quality stuff that looks great and the presentation's awesome, and it's just enough in that flick second of decision where you go, yep, I'm walking down that aisle. You just need a majority. And so if you're contributing to tilting it towards flea market, then you've killed the crowd that'll even come down that row. So that can be a big one. By the way, Brad, I should mention WonderCon. WonderCon is the sister show of Anaheim, and I went this year because it is a hop, skip, and a jump. Like, my fees to exhibit are literally an eighth of a tank of gas to get there. The NCS gets, the National Cartoonist Society, of which I'm a member, gets a free booth, and they have that at like 8 or 9 shows around the country. But I go because it's a free booth, I can just set up shop, and it's easy to go, right? And I did terrible. I did terrible, Brad.
You had no expenses.
I had no expenses. The booth placement couldn't have been better. It was right at the front of the show, and I did terrible. Yeah. And I haven't had this in a while where I literally walked out of the show and been like, nope, never again. Never again am I going to WonderCon. And
this was a big, big mistake.
And listen, I'm sure there were people that did great there. I'm sure there were people that did bad there. And I'm sure there were people in the middle. For whatever reason, I did terrible. And it's a stinging feeling when you're standing at a Comic-Con and not doing great. And you're like, nope. Yeah. I could be at home drawing. I could be at home with my family. I could be lying on a couch. I would rather be anywhere than this right now. So
yeah, and you're trapped inside that building. It's an uncomfortable building. You're trapped there. You're just watching people walk by. Were you exhibiting next to anybody that was interesting you could pass the time with?
I had nice conversations with Luke McGarry, who's a cartoonist
Cool.
Of note on Instagram. And he and I were swapping some tips about Instagram. But in general, I mention it only because I want to reiterate that point that cut it loose if it's a show that even if it had, like, for example, Brad has a Wizard World Philly, I think, right? That's right down the road from you.
Yeah.
And you have cut it loose. But like, this one could not have been easier for me to exhibit at. I pull up to the back of the Anaheim Convention Center. I get out. I put stuff down on a table that's already pre-built for me in this big, beautiful booth. Could not have been easier. The costs were nothing. And yet still, I'm like, nope, F it. I'm never doing that show again.
Never again.
Because even if the conditions are perfect, if you're not making a profit, and by profit, I mean worth the time that you're putting into it, too, then it's not worth going to. Even if it's local, even if it's free, even if all the conditions are perfect.
I'm telling you, Dave, I could walk to the Philadelphia Convention Center. That's how close it is. And I cut that show a good 3 or 4 years ago because it just I wasn't making enough money to spend. And of course, you know, that's a show. I think they turn it into a 4-day show. It was like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Right.
And you're standing there on Thursday, and it's in the summer. It's a beautiful day out. You're standing there Thursday going, what choices have I made that have brought me this low. You know, you just, yeah, you're filled with self-loathing and you know that you still got to make it through Friday, which might be a little bit better once people get off of work, but then you're going to hope for the best on Saturday and you stand there Saturday and you watch tumbleweeds blow down the aisle and you know that Sunday is going to be even worse than Thursday was. And you just, you're filled with hate.
Yeah.
It's like, I could have gotten so much and all the time and energy and money that you put into doing a show. And then you stand there and that happens. It's like, you know, it's really a big part of what brought me around on comic conventions is realizing that I could use this time so much better.
Yeah.
And I'm hurting myself because I'm spending that time before the show, during the show, and after the show, and I'm hurting my, I could have used that, all of those times, so much better.
Well, the thing that I worry about with 95% of the Comic-Con shows out there, and it's encroaching a little bit even on the 5% that I still love, is, and David Malky was the one that isolated this idea for me, so I want to give him credit, is that if they're not selling enough booth space to cartoonists or comics or comic book companies or graphic novel companies or resellers or anything like that, what tends to start to happen at comic shows is you start to get booths that are not at all comics related, but like, oh boy, Chase Bank wants to reach out to you teens because you like comics and Chase Bank believes in signing up new people that also like, or it's like Monster Energy, hey teens, you're here at Comic-Con and we're Monster Energy drinks, or like, hey teens, you like hair ties, right? You want to tie your hair with hair ties? And so you get a lot of booths where you're like, this could be any quote unquote cultural event. And it's not a comics event booth, you know? It's just any event where there are people, you'll have a booth with Monster Energy. But you don't need to have them at a Comic-Con. And when you start to have a critical mass of booths that are not comics, you start to go, well, there's a reason why I'm not selling. And it's maybe in part because this doesn't feel like a comics-focused show anymore, you know?
Oh, listen, at the Philadelphia show the last several years, there's been a guy right out in the middle selling bathtub fittings.
Bathtub fittings?
Bathtub fit? You know, like if your shower is all gross.
I that's the worst I've ever heard.
I'm telling you, you walk around that floor and it was bathtub fittings over here. Hyundai guy with doing some, you know, that clacker, the big tall pole with the bell at the top and you hit the bottom with a mallet and try to ding the bell. Can you imagine that in a concrete and metal convention center? I was three steps away from him all weekend that one. I think that might've been the last time I exhibited at Philadelphia. That was going on, and it was just to sell Hyundais. A guy down there selling sodas. You buy the mug, and you can fill up at the soda truck for the rest of the way. And then you realize, again, like Malky said, this isn't a comic show. What happens then, they turn the corner after filling up their mug of soda and clacking the clacker for a Hyundai and getting a Monster Energy drink. They turn the corner, and they see a comic, and they're like, oh, what the heck? Comics are here too?
Yeah, exactly. So as a cultural event, it becomes an entirely different thing and the expectations change entirely. So, anyway, what's one of the reasons why I love shows, and if you can make them, if they're local to you, really try at some point to exhibit at a show like a TCAF in Toronto or an SPX in Maryland, or even at the NCS Fest in Huntington Beach, shows that are entirely comics. There's nothing else there.
Yeah.
You know, there's no other side thing. There's not even stuff that's parallel to comics. It's just comics. If you can find a show like that, boy, I highly recommend that because you get a very different audience and a very different weekend. Even if your sales are not tremendous, at least you know you failed because it was your work and not because you were next to a Hyundai clapper all weekend, you know?
Yeah. I could at least see the justification in doing
that. Right, it's at least worth trying once because, by God, that entire audience came for comics, not to get a free energy drink and walk around and sign up for Chase Bank because they're reaching out to teens. You know, I don't know. Anyway, I don't see a long life for many of those comic shows. I could name them all.
I think we're winding down. I think we're winding down really big time on the whole idea of a comic convention. I think it's going to be an anachronism very, very soon.
Yeah, I mean, New York will always exist. San Diego will always exist. Emerald City will always exist. C2E2 might go for another 20, 30 years. But you're right. A lot of these like regional, like Midwest Ohio Con, you know, that kind of thing. Like, I don't know. or maybe it just becomes something else and is not at all comics focused. And that's what it is. And who cares, I guess.
Yeah. There was one show I did. They had given me hotel, travel, free booth. I mean, literally, they covered every expense. I didn't make enough money to cover the food that I had ordered that weekend.
Oh,
I
for
went
God's
home
sakes.
In the negative. I went home in the negative.
With a flight, with a hotel, with a booth. Oh,
yeah. I'm telling you, it's for so many years, I went into that gambler's mentality that I talked about here on the show, especially back in the early 2000s and stuff. Well, it was my floor placement. Well, they didn't have enough celebrities at this show. Well, they had too many celebrities at this show. Well, everybody had bought a VIP pass. They didn't have enough money in their pocket when they came to Old Brad. And every time it was like, well, next year is going to be different, right? Because this thing's going to happen and that thing's going to happen. And sooner or later, it starts to dawn on you that this just isn't a good setup. This isn't a great situation to try to do business in. And there, and more importantly, there are better options out there right at your fingertips for being an independent artist. And you just finally come to the point where the light dawns on you and it's like, oh yeah, you know what? This really isn't working.
Yeah. And the flip side to that is if you're an attendee of a show and you are excited to see an artist, it's a little bit not enough to say, oh my God, Brad Geiger, you came to Midwest Ohio Con. I'm such a big fan. Thanks for coming. Bye. Like that a little bit defeats the purpose of why Brad flew out to Midwest Ohio Con. So, in fact, it occurred to me the other day as I was falling asleep that there was an artist from Italy that was at Emerald City Comic Con. And I was so excited to see him. And I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but I was genuinely mad falling asleep the other day at myself because I hadn't gone up and bought something from him because he came all the way from Italy. And even though I didn't get to see him, it's exactly people like me that need to go up and be like, holy shit, I love your work. You came all the way from Italy. Let me buy some prints or a book or something. Like, that's what that exchange should have been. And I was mad at myself that I didn't make the time to leave my booth and go support him from coming all the way from Italy.
Right.
I only mention it because I, as a creator, made the same mistake that I know a lot of other people make, which is I emotionally went, oh, great, he's here, hooray! And then went on my merry way, you know?
Yeah, it's good to know you can be on both sides of that table. You know, sometimes sometimes it happens to us.
Yeah, I admit that exact same failing in that moment, but it was just something. It was good for me to be aware of because when there's an artist that comes to a show, like for example, when we do this NCS Fest in May, Brad, there's going to be a few artists from France that I love. And you bet your bippy, even though it's going to be written in French and I can't read it, I'm going to buy a book or two from them. Because what an incredible trip that they've made to come to Huntington Beach, California to exhibit here. I'm going to support them, especially as it's, for me, the purchase is in local currency. So why not help them out on that very expensive trip that they made and say thank you for coming out?
So, yeah, talking about the NCS, we're going to mention one more time. We're going to be there together. Dave and I are going to be exhibiting at the NCS Fest this May 17th and 18th. Huntington Beach, and we're going to be doing a live Comic Lab recording there, and we're going to be looking for all the Comic Lab listeners. And Dave, where do we point them to if they want to see us there on at noon on Saturday at NCS Fest?
Well, first of all, it's all free, so you can come without buying any ticket and just walk the streets. It's beautiful. It's outdoors. It's like a European festival. And Brad and I will be exhibiting at the corner of Main Street and Walnut Street, which is about a block from the pier. It's really beautiful. And in a way that's only going to haunt us, Brad, we're right next to a Ben and Jerry's, and that's going to be trouble for Daddy. Let me tell you, Papa's going to have some troubles this weekend.
Oh, man, oh, man. Yeah, in more ways than one, because anymore, ice cream doesn't sit necessarily well with me, and we're exhibiting right next to each other. Yeah, you're not. I'm going to have to really be careful on the ice cream.
I think what happened is
you're not going to be downwind.
The National Cartoonist Society saw me tipping towards type 2 diabetes, and they're like, "What can we do to just nudge him right over the edge, and just get him right there in the old type 2 area?" I know, we'll put him right next to Ben and Jerry's. That's what we'll do.
See if we can eat them down to two flavors.
So we are right at the corner of Main Street and Walnut Street, booth C2. Brad and I right next to each other, and also Dave Malky and Jake Parker right next to us, along with 100 other amazing cartoonists. But the Comic Lab show, also free live show, we're going to be in the big ballroom, the Mariners Ballroom of the Hyatt Regency, which is about a block away, and we'll be at noon. It's free. We might even have some surprises. I'm not sure yet for the Comic Lab listeners to come. And, Hyatt Regency in the Mariners Ballroom at noon, that Saturday. And, if you're looking for us, we're also signing all weekend at Main Street and Walnut Street in booth C2. So look for us, at the show there.
Fantastic. And on that note, you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been Brad Geiger, the only one waiting in line for the bus, and also the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And menace to the sea turtle community, Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
You know, I'm actually going to get an email from a marine biologist, Brad, that's like, this is a serious problem, David. This is not something to joke about. You literally cannot touch a 100-year-old sea creature. David, this is not a joking situation.
You can't go back and undo it.
You might as well make a joke out of my own stupidity at this point. All right, anyway, the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from the delightful Andy Creighton, whose music you will love at theworldrecord.net. And this episode and all episodes was edited by the ever-wonderful Matt Woodard at Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab, so we'll say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.
Four, three, two.
That sounded better.
Are you pre-clapping? What are you doing? I'm hearing clapping. Hand.
Well, I'm clapping along with you at 5, 4, 3, 2, so I get into the rhythm.
Okay, no, just for a joke's sake, I just want you to hear this. So clap down, we'll count down from five, and I'll tell you what I hear.
Okay, 5, 4. So the claps don't even.
It's amazing. It's like a kid listening to Blues Clues, and like if you muted Blues Clues, you would just hear yay, yay.
I never even thought that would be the case. Please tell me we're recording.